Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome to the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Strange stuff. I mean, I'm getting messages going in 16 different directions around this whole a ban on offshore drilling. Here, Barbara Lee, this is in the California Chronicle. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, Democrat from Oakland, said in a news release, this was actually 2 years ago, she said, for 25 years, we maintained a bipartisan agreement to ban any new drilling off our shores because we believed it was more important to safeguard the health and beauty of our coastal environment for future generations. Now the Interior Appropriations Bill threatens to upset this agreement and open our coastal areas to drilling despite overwhelming opposition from the American people. And yet, I understand that maybe ban is the wrong word. Congressman Peter DeFazio of Oregon is with us. And Congressman, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, ban sort of as broadly used implies there are no places that are suitable for and available for drilling off of America's coasts. Now, to the contrary, there are 44 million acres off the coast leased. 10.5 million acres of that has been developed, but the other 33.5 million acres are available for offshore drilling.
So, so on the coast, off the coast of California, off the coast of Florida right now,
there's a moratorium on new leases beyond those which are outstanding. Now, I think most of the leases outstanding are probably in the Gulf, but my understanding in talking to Lois Capps from California is there's about to be an agreement to do further drilling, even off Santa Barbara, the most sensitive area in the country, using the existing oil platforms with some new slant drilling, underwater drilling techniques, which are going to be signed off on very broadly. So, you know, there are concerns in particularly inshore drilling in California and other states. But the point is, many of the most promising areas, according to our Mineral Management Service, 80% of the potential available offshore oil, all of it geologically available, not environmentally, is accessible from the existing leases. And then the bigger one that I talked about to other folks, right? Bill Clinton took something that used to be called the Naval Petroleum Reserve, which has massive known reserves, the largest known in
the country.
13.4 billion barrels, known reserves underneath what was called the National Petroleum Reserve, renamed the Petroleum Reserve of Alaska from the Naval Petroleum Reserve.
Right, and this is not ANWR.
No, this is just west of ANWR, the other side of the pipeline.
Right.
It's a little bigger area. It's a little bit further from the pipeline, but not much. And they've drilled 25 test wells and capped them. And it has known reserves. And there is no move to access that oil or anything else.
Let me boil this down, Congressman DeFazio. Number one, the word ban is a Republican meme. This is Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich is orchestrating this thing.
Sure.
And
this is their way back to the majority and the White House, yeah.
Right. What they're trying to do is blame the cost of gasoline, half of which is the result of the decrease in the value of the dollar. The other quarter of which is arguably a function of supply and demand out in the marketplace. Who knows, in speculation, you add them all together. But, I mean, if we were paying for gas in euros right now, we'd be paying $2.25 a gallon. So they're going to try and shift the blame away from the Bush administration and their failed and catastrophic policies onto Democrats and environmentalists, number one. And number two, you're saying that there is not a ban. And in fact, what we've got, I mean, this, I'm looking at this Committee on Natural Resources report, Between 1997 and 2007, the number of drilling permits, now we're actually talking about permits for drilling on public lands, increased by 361%. There's over 10,000 of these permits that the oil companies are simply, they got them, and they're just sitting on them. So it sounds like what they're trying to do is two things. Number one, make political hay with this. And number two, help their buddies, the oil companies, get thousands or millions of more acres of land leased to them so that they can sit on it as it continues to appreciate in value as we slide into peak oil or as the value of oil goes up.
Eureka, you got it nailed, Tom.
That's the bottom line, period.
Wouldn't it be great if they could get whatever other potential areas there are under their control and sit on those too and wait till a day when, you know, they can make even more money on it. This isn't about domestic versus international production. I mean, I, I just point to the former Naval Petroleum Reserve. We sat on that land for 70 years. We knew there were massive oil reserves under it. Clinton leased it. They've drilled it, and they're sitting on it.
The Clinton leased it to the oil companies. So in here, I'm looking at the Department of Energy's website, DOE.gov. Right. Mm-hmm. And they have this thing called the Energy Information Administration, which is a division of the Department of Energy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about the presidential order that George Herbert Walker Bush issued in June of 1990. George H.W. Bush responded to concerns about preserving the ocean and coastal environments with a directive ordering the Department of Interior not to conduct leasing or pre-leasing activities in places other than Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, blah, 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 blah. It says nothing about drilling. So basically, to the extent that there's been a moratorium, it's been a moratorium on giving away more land to the oil companies, not a moratorium on whether or not they can drill federally. Now, do I have that right?
Absolutely. And what I hear from the industry is there's a shortage of drill bits, there's a shortage of rigs, there's a shortage of trained crews. And so that's why many of, and I just got a, American Exploration and Production Council heard me speaking on the floor about an hour ago. And they faxed over a fact sheet, none of which I disagree with. They say, hey, it takes a really long time to develop these leases, get the equipment there, drill them, and do all the things we need to do. And I say, yeah, that's true. But why do you need more in the queue when you haven't dealt with a fraction of the ones you already have?
Right. And all of this entire discussion steps aside of the discussion of, hey, why don't we just develop alternative energy sources and et cetera, or start saving our oil or stop exporting. I mean, we can get into that. But I just want to hit head on this meme that Newt Gingrich and the Republicans are driving so hard right now about, there's this ban. If there is not a ban on drilling, why are they not drilling off the shore of Florida, for example, off the coast of Florida?
Well, there is a ban on new leases off of Florida, and the existing leases, which are, I think, pretty far out off of Florida, they're more off of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Texas. A lot of them are deep water. They require special equipment, and they say there is a shortage of that equipment.
So do individual states like Oregon, for example, you represent Oregon, and I live here. Do individual states ban drilling? Did California, for example, ban drilling off its coast after the disastrous oil spills of the 1980s?
Well, I believe, and I'm not a lawyer, I believe within 3 miles the state has control. Over 3 miles out to 200, it's federal control.
Right.
And but what the Republicans are proposing, Mr. McCain yesterday, the Republicans in the House for the last 2 weeks, is give states the option of banning offshore oil drilling and then give the states more money if they allow it. So try and incentivize states to lift the ban.
Right. But don't states already have that option?
Well, they have the option, I believe, within 3 miles. Beyond that, it would be the federal moratoria off of California.
So is there a federal moratoria on drilling off the shore, off the coast of California? Or just on leasing? Just on
increasing my understanding, leases? Again, from what I know of the Santa Barbara situation, is no, they can, from existing platforms, they've used new technology and they can drill. And there are apparently some promise of some new resources there, but they're not allowed to build new platforms in that coastal zone. But the bottom line is, again, just the sheer number of these things out there. I mean, 6,391 offshore leases on 33.5 million acres of land that are out there available and not being drilled. But the bigger one, the big enchilada here, the former Naval Petroleum Reserve, which has, and they want to talk about ANWR. ANWR has speculative reserves that are not even as great as the known reserves under the Naval Petroleum Reserve. No one knows what's under ANWR because only one well was drilled. It's proprietary, an industry well, and they've never told anybody. So the only thing we have are guesstimates by the Minerals Management Service on what might be there. We know what's under Naval Petroleum Reserve. We've leased significant portions of it. The industry has drilled wells, and they're capped.
They're capped. So basically, ExxonMobil et al., the oil companies, are just basically sitting on oil. And this whole Sturm und Drang that the Republicans are doing right now is A, to try and cast the Democrats as the bad guys in the gas price, and B, to grab more land for more oil in the future so that their oil company buddies can make more money. That's just the bottom line, period, end of discussion.
Absolutely. And remember, you know, the estimates I've seen say that if all these leases that are now available to be drilled and to be developed, including the former Naval Petroleum Reserve, were developed, there would be 20 years supply that would double our domestic production. And that's without any new leases, which is what the Republicans are talking about, new leases. Let's drill what we got, you know, develop it, and then we can talk about more if you really need it.
There you go. Congressman Peter DeFazio, thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
We're voting Republican because we don't like shopping at small neighborhood stores.
We don't want the problem of choosing where to shop.
And we just love cheap plastic crap from China.
I'm voting Republican because I don't really want a cure for AIDS or breast cancer. They're just gays and women.
I'm voting Republican because I think new drugs should be made available immediately, whether they've been tested properly or not. If the major pharmaceutical companies' bottom lines are healthy, then I feel healthy too.
Bye-bye, baby. Have a good day. Here.
I'm voting Republican so that my little Caitlin can be in the classroom with at least 30 other children. That way, she can be challenged by fighting for attention.
I'm voting Republican because women just can't be trusted to make decisions about their own bodies. Never, ever, ever.
I'm voting Republican because I've already seen the great outdoors. Continuing our use of fossil fuels freely is far more important than preserving our natural wildlands.
We're voting Republican because we like a conservative majority on the Supreme Court.
We really like knowing that even if we're separate, we'll still be called equal.
That was an African-American couple. Amazing. Welcome back. And I'm telling you, strange stuff going on in the world, not just with regard to this oil thing. It ain't so. Newt Gingrich is creating something that ain't so and driving it. And that ain't that's not the least of the weirdness that's out there. I mean, the absolute total weirdness that's out there. It's our full Monty alert.
Baby, take off your coat. Real slow.
Yeah, well, in Ashland, Oregon, a woman frequently riding topless on her bicycle plans to be in Ashland's 4th of July parade, free and independent of all clothing.
Baby, take off your dress.
Yeah, except for her hemp G-string, Chamber of Commerce not happy.
Yes, yes, yes.
And here, speaking of G-strings, a Los Angeles woman is suing Victoria's Secret because her thong popped and a decorative piece of metal flew off and hit her in the eye. And Britain's... Oh, here's another one.
Wall over there.
Yeah, Britain's Princess Eugenie was found naked on the ground. She is sixth in line for the throne of England. Britain, 18 years old. She was found naked on the grounds of their school during a drunken fight with pals.
That's right.
Yeah. She's paying $47,000 a year for boarding at Marlborough School. So our full Monty alert for the day. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Linda in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Linda, welcome to the show.
Yes. Hi, Tom. The only banning we need to do is we need to ban Republicans from government.
I think that's a great slogan. Well said. This is incredible that Newt Gingrich is driving this thing. This is, in my opinion, an experiment.
It's
the Republican Party. Well, it's the Republican Party trying to figure out how well they can manipulate the media. Because if you read, I read this morning the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, even progressive blogs like Think Progress, the Center for American Progress, they're all talking about the ban. And I am looking at the language from the Department of Energy. And they talk about June 1990, President George Herbert Walker Bush responded to concerns, blah, 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 with a directive ordering not to conduct leasing or pre-leasing activities. Now, leasing is basically, we're going to give you federal land for, 10 cents a year per acre or whatever. In many cases, it's 2 or 3 cents a year per acre. I mean, for pennies on the dollar. And if you ever get around to drilling on that land, then you pay us a 12.5% royalty or, 12.5%. And so there's not, there may be some local bans on drilling that have to do with, specific sensitive places and things like that. But by and large, what's happening is that the oil companies are accumulating more and more land into which they can drill. And drilling permits. They're sitting on all of these incredible number of drilling permits. They increased 361% during the first 6 years of the Bush administration, or the 7 years now of the Bush administration, through 2007. And in the last 4 years, the Bureau of Land Management has issued 28,776 permits. And yet at that same time, only 18,900 wells were actually drilled. That means that companies have stockpiled nearly 10,000 extra permits to drill that they are not using to increase domestic production. Now, I'm not saying, increasing domestic production is some wonderful high value. Obviously, I think that we should be saving energy. We should be looking at alternatives. But if using the Gingrich frame, you get it that this is another Republican lie.
Yep.
It's just incredible.
So-called energy crisis is just an extortion to bully Congress and the American people into allowing drilling and opening up Anwar and the coast. And it's another of the nefarious plans by Cheney's secret energy task force and for looting America for the next
years. And it's not even to produce more oil. It is to give more oil-bearing land to the oil companies so that they can sit on it and eventually decide when they want to take the oil out of it.
It's the Enron syndrome. They limit the supply. They drive up the prices. Then they set extortionist contracts, and then they increase the supply at the higher prices.
Right, and people say, no, wait a minute, we need this oil to be self-sufficient. We have the oil. We've already leased it to the companies.
Well,
13 billion barrels in the former naval supply up in Alaska, which has already been leased, already been drilled into, and they capped the wells. They're not drilling this oil. The oil companies don't want to put the oil on the market because they already have access to it. They're not putting the oil on the market. This is what's going on. The oil companies are manipulating this entire situation basically for their profits so that down the road, as the cost of oil continues to go up, then they can drill the oil, then they can put the oil on the market. What they want to do right now is expand the number of leases and permits they have, not expand the amount of drilling. They have the full capability of doing that right this minute.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Republican, because I need to be told who I can love.
I told you.
Honey, I need the government to tell me.
I just need them to tell me how I can best show a lifetime commitment.
And Republicans are just the folks to do that, sweetheart.
I'm voting Republican because corporations should not have to pay to clean up environmental damage. The EPA is an outmoded idea. If people want clean water, buy it in a bottle.
I'm voting Republican because I don't want to know if the food I'm eating has been genetically modified or exposed to radiation. I don't want to have to live with that fear, you know? So, if the label says it's food, that's good enough for me.
Yeah, all the great reasons to vote Republican. One of the great viral videos out there. 866-303-2270, our number toll-free all across the United States. TomHartman.com and AirAmerica.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. And Mike in Boston. Hey, Mike, you want to disagree with me? You go up to the front of the line. What's up?
Yeah, I was just, you know, this economy is entirely based on energy, as far as transportation, everything, clothing, plastics. How in the world do you expect to have some huge breakthrough in alternative energy when these oil prices and the oil crisis is strangling the life out of the economy, which is the very thing that's going to provide the investment money to create these alternatives? You have to do both at the same time. You want to completely shut the spigots off of oil.
I am not advocating shutting the spigots off of oil.
That's exactly what the Democrats in Congress have been doing for the last 20 years.
No, it's not. It's not at all. And by the way, it was George Herbert Walker Bush who put this moratorium into place, not Democrats.
He proposed
the moratorium that Bush Jr. wants to reverse right now is a moratorium his father put into place in June of 1990 when he was president of the United States.
That's just one small part of it.
According to the Department of Energy, that's the whole thing.
He wanted to open up ANWR as one of the first things of his administration, and Bill Clinton...
But we don't even know if there's oil in ANWR. What about the fact that there's 13 billion barrels worth of known oil reserves that have already been leased to the oil companies that they already had drilled wells into, and then they capped and they said, we're just going to sit on this for a while. 13 billion barrels of oil.
I think that's an absolute lie. I don't believe that for a second.
Well, you know, check it out, Mike. I recommend you check it out because, you know, it's not just Congressman DeFazio saying it. It's the oil companies saying it. This used to be called the Naval Petroleum Reserve. Everybody knows how much oil is there. I'm telling you, you're being scammed. You're buying in. The Republicans are scamming you, Mike. They are lying to you, and they are scamming you. They're trying to place responsibility for a disastrous financial policy, fiscal policies, which have dropped the value of the dollar in half and thus account for more than half of the increase in the cost of oil because the dollar is in half, because we don't manufacture anything here anymore. We no longer have a dollar that represents value because our country no longer represents value. And this is the result of 30 years of Reaganomics. What you're seeing is Reaganomics coming home to roost. Terry in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Terry.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You put that guy straight there, but you're beating your head against the wall with them Republicans. I think what's going on is the Enroning of America, much like the politicians and the corporate Enron people got together to create the brownouts in California that cost Gray Davis his job. I think they're doing the same thing to the whole American people.
Yep, and Ken Lay was having that secret meeting with Arnold Schwarzenegger just as the brownouts were beginning, long before anybody was talking about him being governor. And then, gee, look at this. Didn't this work out nice?
Exactly. And now all of a sudden, Crist down in Florida changes his mind and Bush is doing his thing in conjunction with McCain.
It's all about politics. Yeah, no, the American people actually, in this regard, tragically are stupid because the media, I mean, you look right across the board. Everybody is talking about the drilling ban. And what this is really all about is ending the lease moratorium that George Herbert Walker put into place that is not giving them more land. And one of the reasons, for not ending the moratorium is that they're sitting on 10,000 leases where they know that there's oil and they're not drilling them. They're sitting on the Naval Petroleum Reserve up in Alaska with 13.5 billion barrels of oil and they're not drilling it. The oil companies have all the oil that they need or all the oil that they want right now. They could flood the U.S. with oil, but they're not drilling it. Why? Because to do so would drive down the price and decrease their profitability. These guys are not idiots. Terry, thank you very much for the call. Well said. Dan in Michigan. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to point something out. The next talking point that's going to be coming out of the right is that, yes, we have these leases. The oil companies have these leases, but we can't drill them because the environmentalists are suing us and they're keeping us from drilling. So I just thought I'd bring that to your attention. It's already come up in conversations that I've had with people about this.
Oh, it's been out there for years. And the fact of the matter is that there are some environmentally sensitive areas where you know, they shouldn't be drilling. But it's such a tiny fraction of the overall. It is virtually irrelevant. But Dan's spot on and well said. Thank you very much. Mark in Ventura, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how are you doing today, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Listen, Tom, one of your best habits is that you take right-wing callers and put them to the top of the line. And we all hear when they're coming from a different, totally different point of view with their facts. I mean, they're wrong on the facts a lot of the time, right?
Well,
why don't you bet them $1,000 on the facts with the money to go to a veterans organization or something like that?
Yeah, because I don't want to encourage gambling. Basically, you know, it's and then basically what you've done is, you know, you've stuck yourself to somebody. But I think that people listening, Mark, good point though. Thank you. I think people get it that this whole argument on the right or on the Reich is devoid of reality. And what they're doing is they're putting a new meme out there, and the lapdog media, the corporate media. Now, many of these large corporations that control our media, by the way, having interlocking boards of directors with the oil companies. You can see it over at theyrule.net. You just see who's on the board of each of these corporations. It can be very startling. I recommend you check it out. Mark in Oakland, California. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom. How are you this morning?
Just fine. What's up?
Well, you know, if George really wanted to do something about oil today, and he's been very remiss in doing so, why not just release some of the bloody oil out of the SPROL, the Strategic Petroleum Oil Reserve?
Yeah.
He could absolutely do that by executive order, bingo, today.
I predict that he will do that in October.
That's a good possibility.
See, there's no point in doing it right now. Right now, let the Republicans and the Democrats beat each other up. And then you do it in October, the price of gas drops all of a sudden very precipitously. Everybody goes, oh, look at that. He did it again. Isn't he wonderful? The Republicans, they know what they're doing. I guess we'll vote for John McCain.
The other side, Tom, is that, you know, the oil that's in the ground that these oil companies have under lease that they know is there that they don't want to produce as yet also just goes into what's known as their reserves, and they have a value on those reserves.
That's right.
They don't have to tap it, but those known reserves that they have contribute to the overall stock price.
That's right. It increases the value of the corporation, and then they compensate their executives with stock and stock options, and everybody wins except the American consumer. Excellent point, Mark. Thank you very much for making it. Robinson in Wayne, New Jersey. Hey, Robinson.
How you doing, Mr. Tom?
I'm well. How are you, Robinson?
I'm beautiful. I just want to say one word. The guy who called earlier about the Democrats holding up the oil reserves and things like that,
I told your
screener that I just want to say that he's an idiot. I just want everybody to hear that he's an idiot. That's all.
Okay. Well, you said it, Robinson. Thanks a lot for the call. I just think he's misinformed. At a certain point, we have to get to the point. I think Barack Obama's trying to take us in that direction where we get it that we're all Americans here. We all have shared interests. And we need some good, clean information. And how about good, clean information like the reality that it was George Bush Sr. who put a moratorium on passing out more leases, that the oil companies are sitting on 10,000 drilling permits, not just leases, 10,000 drilling permits, and they're sitting on 33 million acres of offshore oil, land, you know, leased for oil and natural gas, into which they could drill. And they're not using it. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TJ in Los Alamos, New Mexico. Hey, TJ, listening to KABQ.
Oh, hi, Tom. Boy, I was surprised to get in so soon. I am a co-owner of a Texas natural gas well that was capped by George Herbert Walker Bush, which radically reduced any income that could come to the owners.
Right, that was capped by him?
It was capped by the administration of the George Herbert Walker Bush administration.
How so?
I'm sorry?
How so?
How so? Well, I guess there was a law that was issued that they were all capped and they were no longer to pump gas from those wells.
Huh. The company that has the rights to draw that well? I'm assuming it's your land and
well, no. What it is our mineral rights.
Right.
And
so you've leased out the mineral rights to a company.
The company? No, we didn't sell the mineral rights to them. We own the mineral rights. They.
Right.
Lease the opportunity to pump it and to pay us the percentage of what.
Right, and they then capped it and said we're going to continue
because of laws that were issued during the administration of George Herbert Walker Bush.
Have you checked to find out if that's actually true?
Yes, and it was done to protect, as what we were told, the prices of gas, and
from my experience here in New Mexico, I know the same is true of silver and gold mines and turquoise mines. And I guess the same is true of diamonds in Africa.
Interesting.
But it's all done to keep the prices up.
TJ, if you could post on our blog any documentation you can find, any links to that, because I've not seen anything that would back that up in the press. I would love to see it. I just go over to TomHartman.com and post it there.
Okay, that was done quite a number of years ago.
Yeah.
I had to hunt it up and scan it into the computer. But
if you could, it would be much appreciated. Thank you, TJ, for the call. We've got to take a break here. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm voting Republican because
I really enjoy being screwed by the utility company.
We need more minorities in prison.
Because hybrid cars really suck.
I just don't feel I deserve health insurance.
Because Texas needs more billionaires.
I'm voting Republican because sometimes the Constitution is just one big inconvenient headache.
I think the whole world should be run by one big corporation. I think it would be so much cozier.
Because all other countries are inferior to us.
And we should start as many wars as we need to keep it that way.
So I can stay in Iraq.
So I can go to Iran.
So if you were thinking about voting something besides Republican, don't bother. Stay home. We've got it all taken care of. You'll get exactly what you deserve.
Yeah, there you go. A great new Republican ad. As they say, from the wire services, in a major speech today on Iraq, presumptive GOP nominee John McCain said that the Iraqis have split into two factions, Shiites and Sunnis, with a sinister goal in mind. My friends, Senator John McCain told an audience in a retirement village in Scottsdale, Arizona, the Iraqis have divided themselves into these two groups for one reason and one reason only. They are trying to confuse me. Senator McCain said that although the two groups of Iraqis are well-nigh impossible to tell apart, he vowed to commit U.S. troops to Iraq for as long as it takes me to figure out just what is the difference between Sunnis and Shiites. If it takes 100 years, 1,000 years, or a bazillion zillion years, we will stay there until I can tell Sunnis and Shiites apart, the Arizona senator said. Senator McCain reserved his harshest words for the Shiites, who he said were trying to confuse him by sometimes referring to themselves as Shiites and other times referring to themselves as the Shia. What's that all about anyway, he asked. Stop clowning around and call yourself one thing. And Senator McCain seemed alarmed when a reporter asked him whether he believed the Kurds, the third major group in Iraq, were trying to confuse him as well. The Kurds? He said, who the heck are they? Elsewhere, a carjacker in Los Angeles stole a tank of gas but left the Mercedes. Thanks to Andy Borowitz, a Borowitz report, tongue-in-cheek news of the day, but Laura Logan on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart talking about the situation in Iraq, make this a little more serious. Here's Laura Logan.
I was asked once, do you feel responsible for the American public having a bad view, a negative view of the war in Iraq? And I looked at the reporter and I said, tell me the last time you saw the body of a dead American soldier. What does that look like? Who in America knows what that looks like? Because I know what that looks like. And I feel responsible for the fact that no one else does. You know? That's what I feel responsible for, that nobody really understands. And the soldiers do feel forgotten. They do. No doubt, from Afghanistan to Iraq, they absolutely feel... You know, it hasn't... We may be tired of hearing about this 5 years later. They still have to go out and do the same job. I was in Sutter City when it was just going absolutely hell for... I mean, Sutter City was like Armageddon. And there were soldiers that had been in country 9 months, had never seen combat like that. Just thrown into it. Didn't, you know... You're talking about convoys ambush with 5, 6 armor-piercing bombs, rocket-propelled grenades, everything. 9, 10, 15-hour battles. And more soldiers died in Afghanistan last month than Iraq. Who's paying attention to that? 33,000, highest troop levels since the war began. 7 years after we defeated the Taliban.
It's already over.
Yeah, 7 years after we defeated the Taliban. And Iraq, in my opinion, Afghanistan, another war that we shouldn't have gone into. You know, when the Taliban offered to give us bin Laden, if we would simply turn him over to a third nation for a trial, you know, like put him in the dock at The Hague rather than in the United States, we should have said, great, we'll take him. Larry, or we'll let them take him. Larry in Portland. Hey, Larry.
Tom, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. Hey, how about a quick suggestion here for a sort of a one-size-fits-all catchphrase as far as a comeback to the inspiration. I hope I'm not late with this, but the inspiration as far as Gingrich's comment and Republican and conservative lies and false information, et cetera, lie of Newt.
Lie of Newt. That's a great one, as in the old witch's brew. Thank you, Larry. Well, or Larry, well said. Scott in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Scott.
Hey, how are you doing, Tom?
Fine. Thank you.
Basically, I was wondering, can we take these leases back from these oil companies and give it to another oil company that would actually use these?
Interesting question. I'm guessing that we probably have the statutory authority to do that. The problem is that you have such a small number of oil companies that they're essentially operating as a cartel, or they are a cartel. You know, OPEC, they call themselves a cartel, and they're operating independent of any, you know, specific oversight. And so, you know, what do you do? Liz in Valley Glen, California. Hey, Liz.
Hi,
what do we do?
Tom. Good morning. I want to talk about something that you spoke about before, about John D. Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure I heard it on your show about how he funded the temperance movement. And essentially, because he funded the temperance movement because the farmers at that time brewed their own alcohol to put in the car, because the cars back in the 20s could run on alcohol or gasoline.
Yeah,
he wanted to eliminate that. Well, there's two more parts to that puzzle. The second part, I was at the chiropractor the other day talking about my vitamin B, and he said, well, you know that's made from oil. And I said, what? And, yeah, he went on this whole tirade about how John D. Rockefeller, back in the 20s, funded research facilities at different medical schools, or it might have been even earlier than the 20s, and then let that go for a couple of years, and then went back to the government and said, shouldn't we have some standards about medical schools and what's qualified as actual medicine?
Right.
And then eliminated a lot of the alternative methods.
No, Liz, John Rockefeller did an enormous amount of damage to this country, I'll tell you. The biggest one was you know, getting the states going into the charter-mongering era. Thank you for the call. Rob in Olympia, Washington. Rob, we have a half a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour.
Yeah, morning, Tom. I was just calling to say that there's a ton of information on the NPR Alaska Reserve and showing many of the leases that are in place. It's a good source. And then also, I've worked in the oil and gas industry, and there's thousands of capped wells in the lower 48 that they're just sitting on. So
I know there's a lot of them in the Midwest. There were wells
exactly.
that were capped in the 70s when I was living in Michigan. There are wells in farmers' fields just down the house, you know, just 20
exactly.
miles from my family's house.
Yep.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Rob. These big companies are basically just sitting on this oil saying, it's an appreciating asset. And it increases the value of our stock. So why should we pump the stuff out? Wait till oil hits $200 a barrel. Then they'll pump it up. Amazing. Terry Jeffrey coming up next with CNS News.
Tom Hartman.
Taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day, 5 days a week.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The True People's Radio.
Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. A couple of things here. By the way, our quote for the day, cats, this is from Jeff Valdez, cats are smarter than dogs. You can't get 8 cats to pull a sled through the snow. Well said. By the way, we have new videos up over at TomHartman.com. One is the Beware of Higgins video. Another is Ralph Reed and I. This is where I asked him if he felt that as a Christian and as a conservative, he should be seeking repentance for all the death and bloodshed in Iraq. It's very interesting. And also I'd like to just toss out to say to all of the gay couples who are getting married in California right now. It's in the news, it's all over, and it's happening. That as a guy who has been married to the same person for 35 years, welcome to the institution of marriage. I think it's a fine thing, and I think it's absolutely wonderful that we can welcome into the family of Americans, of married Americans, which is not to say there's anything wrong with being single Americans, but nonetheless, welcome to the family of married Americans to gay couples in California. We've been talking, in the last hour, we've been talking about oil. And Congressman Peter DeFazio coming on pointing out that, in fact, I gave that study to you, Louise, I need it back. Pointing out that there's over 10,000, thank you, Sean, over 10,000 drilling permits that the oil companies are sitting on, that they're not using on these lands. There's the 28,700 permits that were issued between 1999 and 2007, only 18,000 wells, 954 wells were actually drilled. These are all permits. The reason that it got to the permit level is that they know that there's oil under the ground. These are all that means that the oil companies, this from the Committee on Natural Resources, the majority staff report, The Truth About America's Energy, Big Oil Stockpile Supplies and Pockets Profits, that means that oil companies have stockpiled nearly 10,000 extra permits to drill that they are not using to increase domestic production. Of the 47.5 million acres of federal lands that are currently being leased by oil and gas companies, only about 13 million acres are actually in production. And offshore, they have 44 million acres leased. They're only producing out of 10 million, and they have the legal right to drill right now into the additional 33 million. What this is all about, what this whole Gingrich Republican thing is all about, is giving the oil companies more leases and more drilling permits when they're not using the ones that they have right now. It's using a crisis to increase their profits and their bottom line, in my opinion. Terry Jeffrey is with us. He's the editor-in-chief of CNSnews.com. And, Terry, you've heard my pitch. Your take on it?
Well, I think I can offer an explanation for some of that. I can't specifically say what each one of those leases are, but I would refer people to a report that the Bureau of Land Management put out just last month. I'm looking at it right now on my computer. I downloaded the PDF a couple weeks ago. We've done a lot of reporting on it. It's called Inventory of Onshore Federal Oil and Natural Gas Resources and Restrictions to Their Development. It was produced by the Department of Interior as a result of the Energy Policy Act of 2005. But, Tom, what it says in short is that even the land that is leasable for oil in the United States and some of the places where these leases are, oil companies cannot effectively drill because of a multitude, mostly of environmental regulations.
Right, but that's leasable. What about the 33 million acres that they already have leased?
No,
that they're sitting on?
No,
and what about the 10,000 drilling permits that they have that they're not using?
Right. Well, let me offer. I can't specifically address these particular drilling leases. But what this report says is that even on the land that is leasable, and presumably where there are leases, environmental regulations, sometimes that are very specific to a particular place.
These 33 million leased acres are leased for exploration. It's already been licensed.
I understand
It's ready to go.
Wait a minute. But here's an explanation for what people can look
at. There's 33 million acres offshore, by the way. It's 44 million acres onshore.
Okay, but let me answer your question. This report put out by the BLM last month points out that even though this land is leasable, much of the leasable land, the land that has been leased, cannot be drilled because in practical terms what needs to be done to actually drill the oil cannot be done because it runs afoul of one or another federal regulation or law, most of those laws and regulations involving the environment.
Yeah,
people want
like
to know the details, they can read the report because every single region in the United States where there's oil, this report goes detail by detail by detail and shows the law and regulation.
Well, of course, we want to protect our environment. But you're talking about bananas while I'm talking about apples, Terry. I'm talking about leases that have been granted, permits that have been given for drilling. The federal government has said go for it. For example, what used to be called the Naval Petroleum Reserve up in Alaska.
Right.
It's now referred to as the Federal Reserve. It's $13.5 billion with a B. barrels of oil known to exist there.
Right.
It's already been leased to the oil companies. They were given permits to drill. They drilled. They already had, and they capped the wells. They have been sitting on this stuff since the first Bush administration, not because anybody told them to, but because they have chosen not to pump that oil. The infrastructure is there. They could get it to shore, or they could get it to the coast and put it into tankers. They could be bringing it down to the north, to the rest of North America. They're choosing not to do so. They're not explaining why they're choosing not to do so, but we're talking about 13 billion barrels of oil that's already got a straw sticking out of it.
Right. Well, I can't address why that particular company is not drilling in that particular area. I would guess that is not profitable for them. I will tell you that, wait a minute, the same BLM report, anybody can look it up on the Internet and read it themselves. It says, according to the official estimate of the Department of Interior, they say there's 139 billion barrels of what they call undiscovered, technically recoverable oil in the United States. This is oil that with our current technology we could go get, that through reasonable science they believe is there. Most of it, 85.9 billion barrels, is offshore. Tom, that is more oil than Iran has. It's more oil than Iraq has.
I understand that, but you're talking about things like oil shale and things like that.
No, you're talking about technically recoverable.
No, I'm talking about actual oil that we know is in the ground right now.
No, that's not what I'm talking about. This is not shale oil. This is regular oil. This is the kind of oil they're pumping out of existing oil wells in the United States that can be recovered, according to the Department of Interior, with current technology.
Okay, so what you're saying is that what you're identifying, Terry, is all that oil that the oil companies want to add to their portfolio right now, using this crisis as the rationale, and then they won't drill it anyway drilling the stuff they have.
That's you and me. Maybe you have some wealthy listeners out there. Why don't they invest in you and me? You and me will start an oil company. We'll convince these bozos in the government to let us go out there and drill it, and you and me will make money. If Exxon and Mobil, if the big oil companies don't want to do it, I'll do it.
There's a bunch of small oil companies that are out there as well. Apache and others, and I mean, it's not just the big ones, but they're all playing basically the same game. I mean, the people in this industry know what's going on. They're not dummies.
Well, look, people can read the government's own report. This was something that was done at the behest of Congress. It's gotten very little attention, and it is just a fact that most of this oil cannot be drilled let me give you a specific example of the sort of thing they say. Okay, there's some places where there's oil under federal land. Leasing is allowed, but you can only work on the surface of the land for 3 months because of the Endangered Species Act. Or you can't even disturb the surface of the land because of the environmental regulations.
Yeah.
But you can buy a lease.
Again, you're talking about the banana, I'm talking about the apple. But, you know, and I think that it's a good thing, by the way, that's the case. We want to protect this planet upon which we live and the web of life that we're a part of. But let's, at least in my opinion, I know you're disagreeing with that, but in the couple minutes we have left, and maybe we can carry this over the break, I wanted to get into this article that you wrote because I thought that this was great. It's titled "The Threat to the Car," by Terrence Jeffrey. We're talking with Terrence Jeffrey, the editor-in-chief at CNSnews.com. And you say, some liberals would like to use government to force Americans out of their cars. They believe in socialized transportation, not free market transportation. In a free market transportation system, a person purchases his own vehicle with his own money, buys his own gas with his own money, and can drive his vehicle anywhere there is a road. I think you missed a word in there, Terry. Can drive his vehicle anywhere there is a socialist road.
Mm-hmm.
Our highway system is socialist.
Well, listen, I think it's
the only thing that makes it possible for you to have this, what you call a free market car system.
Well, you know what, and I do concede that point in my column, that these roads are generally paid for by the government. And I concede that, and I would say, look, you know, as long as there's a net balance between the taxes that are taken from drivers to pay for roads and bridges and the amount of money that's paid to build roads and bridges, that's fine with me.
So you are in favor of socialism?
Well, to that extent, yes. I think that is a social compact we've made in the United States. And my point
is, why are you opposed to public transportation?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because another thing I point out in my column is that when you own your own car and you can put your own gas in it, and we have this massive system of roads that we, with our gas taxes and other taxes, have built, we have the freedom to go where
our,
we want.
Our socialist road system has given us that freedom. Terry, let's continue this conversation after the break. We're talking with Terry. If that's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay, great. We're talking to Terry Jeffrey. He's the editor-in-chief at CNSnews.com. The Threat to the Car. You can read Terry's piece over at CNSnews.com. Are we going to continue to be a socialist nation on our roads? I think it's a great question. 16 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
the Tom Hartman Program.
Truth in Broadcasting.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Let me tell you, there's going to be days like these. There's going to be days. Oh, man, all the strange stories out there. Oh, it's the liberals who are trying to take your gas away. No, sorry. 30 years of Reaganomics and George Bush is destroying the infrastructure of this country. Speaking of the infrastructure of this country, Terry Jeffrey with us, the editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com. Terry, you've acknowledged in your article and in our conversation that if we didn't have a socialized highway system, people wouldn't have the so-called free market freedom to drive their car. We also have a socialized economic system in as much as the government is stabilizing our and providing us with a stable currency system to the money that you'd use to buy the car. The government is involved in whether the cars are going to produce pollution that kills people and whether they're designed to be safe. I mean, at what point do you, and people can drive the car because they can read because they got a socialist education and a free public school system?
I didn't get a socialist education.
I will resist the urge to make a smart aleck remark here. No, actually, you're a very smart guy, Terry, and I acknowledge that. And in fact, two of my three kids didn't altogether. You know, we had one that we homeschooled and one that went to a private school. So I've seen all three of them.
Good for you.
But in any case, you're suggesting that we should go to a totally non-socialist, free market transportation system, and you're trashing. It seems to me that the main point for your trashing public transport, you know, the buses and subways and trains and things, is that they limit freedom of choice. And I'm wondering, have you ever traveled around in Europe?
Yeah, I have, as a matter of fact. But look, I take your point, Tom. I'm not an anarchist and I'm not a libertarian. And I understand that there's a certain amount of collective activity we engage in here, so we have our modern transportation system with paved highways and cars that we can drive on. Once upon a time, people used to wander around the countryside in horses. We don't do that anymore. But I think there's a couple of places where it balances. First is just one in what the Constitution says and limits on government. That's not so crucial here. I think what's more crucial here is, for me as a conservative and someone who believes individual liberty is, in fact, one of the things at the core of what America's all about, it's always a question of dependence and independence. And I think we want to the degree it's practically possible, maximize individual independence without stomping on other people's rights, without doing things that are immoral, and minimize government dependence. And I do see a trend in American society to force people to be dependent on the government for their movement. Once upon a time, not so long ago, I think the left in this country resisted that. If you look at cultural icons of the left in the 50s and 60s, there are people like Jack Kerouac, who wrote On the Road, who was driving around with Dean Moriarty, Neil Cassidy, all around the country in cars.
Yeah.
In the 1960s, you had rock and roll celebrating the car, and we're talking about every kind of rock and roll. You had Ken Kesey in his bus, and it was a privately owned bus that went where he wanted to go. It seems to me that that independence and that mobility and that freedom of movement is built into the American soul. And there is an element in our culture and our politics that wants to take it out.
Well, Terry, I will acknowledge, I'll agree with you, and to a certain extent, and acknowledge that there is that Davy Crockett, you know, I've got mine, I'm going to toss on my coonskin cap and take my gun and go out and carve a new life out of the American wilderness. But the reality is that most of the framers of the Constitution, the founders of this country, were far more communalists than they were libertarians. I mean, the whole idea of creating this country was for the public good. It wasn't for the individual. I mean, it was certainly they were celebrators of individual rights and individual liberties. But you can't have individual rights and liberties if the public is unstable. I mean, that was the big point that they made. It was like Franklin Roosevelt in his 36 renomination speech in Philadelphia. He quoted an old English judge once said, "A necessitous man is not a free man. You're not free if you're hungry. You're not free if you're afraid that one illness is going to kill you. You're not free if you can't hop on a public bus and get to work if you can't afford a car."
Well, there's a little too much materialism in your analysis for me, but I'm not a libertarian, as I said, and I think true conservatives believe in ordered liberty, and that, you know, we believe in a level of government that is prudent for the protection of liberty, and I don't think people should be able to go.
But you're essentially calling for doing away with public transportation here.
No, I'm not calling for doing away with public transportation. I think it should pay for itself, and I definitely think that there is a movement, and you can see it around Washington D.C., where government is willfully and with a strategy attempting to drive people out of their cars and put them in public transportation. Let me give you a scenario, Tom. I was in Washington D.C. on September 11, 2001, and I found a clever way out of town, and I was able to go pick up some of my kids. My wife was able to get in another car, go to another school, and pick up our kids. I would not want to be in Washington, D.C., dependent on government transportation if there were another terrorist attack. I'd want my own transportation, and I want to be ready to go where I want to go.
So you'd want to be on the roads that are clogged up and choked up and nobody's moving. I mean, if there was a real disaster,
I might have a better strategy for getting out than another guy. For protecting my family than another guy.
Okay, it's an interesting debate. Terry, I'm sorry, we got to wrap up. CNSnews.com is his website.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at
4 minutes past the hour. Isn't it sweet? Michelle Obama, she's on The View. She says, "I'd like to be greeted properly." Fist bumps all around. Ah, that's great. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you'd like to participate in our blog, our live chat, you'll find links both at TomHartman.com and AirAmerica.com. Bruce in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Bruce, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I was thinking your last gentleman on the phone,
Terry Jeffrey,
should grab his little car and find his own little private island and invite a bunch of his friends. It seems like that kind of individualism doesn't really contribute to any real solution, you know?
Well, I think this is the fundamental cleavage between the liberal and conservative worldview, and Michael Moore said it so brilliantly in his movie Sicko, where there was that moment in the movie toward the end where he turned to the camera and he said, ultimately, and I'm paraphrasing from memory here, but I think this is pretty much what he said. He said, ultimately, we all have to collectively decide, are we society or a me society?
Exactly.
And thank you, Bruce. And I would submit that the me society mentality, which is grounded in Reagan conservatism, the me society mentality is what is destroying this country. John in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, John.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah.
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can. Welcome to the show.
Bruce kind of summed it up for me. I was going to comment on Terry Jeffries. I see him on CNN all the time. And it's that every man for himself mentality. And they always bring up the disaster scenario too. You know, he won't be able to get out of town or anything, or the Jack Bauer 24 mentality where we have to torture to get the information.
Right. But here's the question. And Terry's not here, and so I don't want to pick on him, and B, I don't want to ask him questions when he's not here. But I think the question largely that we have to ask as a nation. You know, if we're going to come together as a nation, which is one of the stated goals of Barack Obama's candidacy, if we're going to bring America back together and start healing the wounds that really began with Nixon, as we learned yesterday with the author of Nixonland, that of the intentional tearing apart of America. When Roger Ailes was first hired to make Richard Nixon seem more likable and all that kind of stuff. If we're going to heal the wounds of the Roger Ailesness, how do we bring together both sides of that discussion? I mean, here, Terry is saying, yeah, okay, I'll acknowledge that the highway system is socialist. And yet, his argument is that without the highway system, he can't have freedom. And that's my point. And so I think that at a certain level, we're saying the same thing. We're just saying it in different ways. And there has to be a way to bridge that gap so that Americans get it, that we have to have both individual liberties and freedoms on the one hand and what Terry calls socialism, that is a community, the web of society, of culture that underpins and supports us and that catches us when we fall, when we become very, very ill or lose our jobs or have disasters befall us.
Right. Well, I'm a social studies teacher here in Ann Arbor, mm-hmm. and I really enjoy you talking about the commons.
Yeah.
I try and instill that, when I teach civics classes or history classes or anything like that. I try and teach my students to be citizens instead of employees or consumers or anything like that.
Yeah.
That idea of the commons and the common good as stated in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
There's really been loss in our society, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, very well said, John. Thank you very much. And thanks for teaching really important stuff. That's great that you're out there doing it. God bless you. That's wonderful. Calvin in Washington, D.C. Hey, Calvin.
Hi, I just wanted to respond to the previous guest. I actually, as he mentioned, I live in Washington, D.C., and he talks about 9/11. We have, in Washington, you've been here. I was here for your Green Convention thing last year.
Oh, great.
And you probably saw our metro.
Over the last 30 years, I've probably spent in aggregate 6 months in Washington, D.C. I've used the metro a lot.
Okay. Well, for the national listeners who don't know what it is, it's a modern subway system. It goes across the entire region, has arms out into the suburbs, and it has roughly 750,000 riders a day.
Right, and it covers two states plus the District of Columbia.
Yeah, and so for this previous guest to sit there and talk about Washington and how he wants his car, we don't have highways in Washington. They were canceled by our forebears so we could have a metro, and our city is a much, much better place because of it. In Washington, you can walk around. You can walk around all hours of the night, most neighborhoods, feel safe, and go hop on the metro and get around. You're not shackled to paying $4 a gallon. You're not shackled to paying $15 a day for parking. You're not shackled to sitting in traffic. His entire concept of freedom is this crazy GM-inspired mid-century fantasy. To me personally, I use the metro, I use the bus every single day because I don't like being shackled to $4 a gallon gasoline.
Right. I guess the question is, are the people in Los Angeles who don't have a functioning public transportation system, because it was bought up by Firestone and GM back in the 20s and destroyed,
right.
Are the people in L.A. freer and happier with regard to transportation than the people in Washington, D.C. or in Manhattan, where there's also an excellent public transportation system under the roads, under the highways, under the city that was put mm-hmm. into place back in the 19th century?
Well, New York's a perfectly good example, too. New York rejected most of their freeways and instead chose years later beefed up the subway system. And
right.
The reason why is because if you have freeways slicing through everything, you can't have any sort of walkable town. You're stuck in pollution. No one wants to live next to a freeway. And it just basically salts the earth in terms of livable human communities. So this entire car thing, it was a wonderful idea in 1948 when we were coming out of World War II and needed a way to put people to work. But I think that the horse left the barn, a good 10 years ago.
Well,
and now
also,
we're just sending our dollars out of the country to the Middle East.
Yeah, and it's also a wonderful thing in many parts of the country where you really seriously do have to drive a half hour to get to the next community. And,
mm-hmm.
Even in Europe, I lived in rural Germany for a year, and there are a lot of communities that you just can't get to by train or places that you really do need a car. And that's why we need to be looking at, hydrogen fuel that is where the hydrogen is created from electrolysis of water using solar power or wind power or electric cars, things like that. I mean, there have to be those options, but they ultimately, I think, need to be the less common rather than the more common. Well said, Calvin. Thank you very much for the call. I truly appreciate it. Richard, New York City. Hey, Richard.
Hi. I was in New York. I was in Washington, D.C. on September 11, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And on the next day, I had to come to New York. My city needed me, you know.
Yeah.
And I hopped on Amtrak. It was running. It was.
Yeah.
There were very few people on it. About 25% of the seats were occupied.
Yeah.
And
it's fast. It's efficient. It's clean. And
that's
absolutely.
How they should have gotten the victims of Katrina out of New Orleans. There's a train that goes train line that goes directly from New Orleans to Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I think that part of that was destroyed, but good point, Richard. Thank you very much. And the other hidden cost, and this is something that I think is really worth pointing out. We think we're paying $4 a gallon for gasoline. We're actually paying $10 a gallon for gasoline or more, because where there's an additional $4 a gallon that you're paying in your federal income taxes to pay for the military protection of the transportation and refinery of oil all around the world that ends up in the tank of your gas, that ends up in that gallon of gasoline. So there's an additional $4 that we spend on military infrastructure per gallon of gas, and there's an additional at least $2 to $3 a gallon that we are all paying in added health insurance costs and health costs and loss of productivity to society as a consequence of all the cancers people get and other diseases, asthma and other diseases that are associated with the overuse of cars, the burning of fossil fuels into our atmosphere. So, we need to keep that in mind. Sarah in Los Angeles is listening to K-Talk. Hey, Sarah.
Hi. I live in Los Angeles and I have to drive and I have to commute every day. And it's horrible. I feel shackled to my car. I hate making a car payment. I hate paying for insurance. I hate paying for the gas. I've lived in Seattle previously where it has a great transportation system. You can get on the bus every day. You can walk everywhere. You can have a car if you want to get out of the city, but you don't need it to live in the city. And I felt more free as an individual when I lived in Seattle, when I could jump on the bus or I could walk to, you know, everywhere.
Like, so Your experience is that socialist transportation systems produce greater freedom. I mean, here in Portland, we have a very, very advanced public transportation system. And if you're just moving within the city center, within the downtown area, you don't even have to pay. It's free.
Right.
I mean, although they're having some problems with that, you know, with folks just kind of basically living on the train. So they're thinking of charging a perfunctory rate. But nonetheless, the point is, I think that I agree with you that public transportation. Thank you, Sarah, for the call. Public transportation enhances freedom, doesn't reduce it. So what are we going to do about transportation? What are we going to do about oil? What are we going to do about all this stuff? Jeremy in Reno, Nevada. Hey, Jeremy.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to get your ideas about a suggestion that I have, and that's a windfall profits tax with an exemption for those oil companies that go into these reserves that they're just sitting on. I think that that would do well in Congress because the Republicans would have a really hard time standing up and saying, well, no, we don't want to do this. And it would strike a strong blow at Bush's use of the bully pulpit today.
Yeah. It's an interesting point, Jeremy. Here's the balance that we need to keep in mind. On the one hand, I mean, the first hour of our show today, we talked about how the oil companies are manipulating the price and value of oil, the availability of oil, keeping oil off the market, increasing their stockpiles, thus increasing their assets, their under the ground assets, and saying, you know, hey, look, we're more profitable, we've got more oil, our stock prices are going up, our executives make more money, on the one hand. And on the other hand, and therefore saying, well, maybe we should have them drill that oil because that would reduce the price of oil. But then on the other hand, do we really want all that oil drilled? Do we really want all that carbon dioxide pumped into the atmosphere? Do we really want to melt down the planet? I don't think so. There's a balancing act here.
Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Talk to you.
Oh, don't be scared about the future. We're going to change it all for the better. 9.5 minutes before the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And congratulations. You know, when I do these caught you doing something right things, we're all kind of trained, I think, perhaps by childhood. You know, a parent with little kids, the first thing, the first word that most little kids say is no, because the parents are, they're trying to protect them. No, don't run out in the street. No, don't put your hand in the stove. No, don't touch that hot iron, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so we tend to catch people doing things wrong. And instead, we need to be catching people doing things right. You know, you helped put together a great show today, Sean. Thank you. And you too, Louise. And it's, you know, like catching you doing things right. So, I want to catch Senator Jack Reed, the Democrat from Rhode Island, doing something right. Here he is, and our, you know, caught you doing something right for the day. Jolly good fellow. And here he is talking to William Haynes. He's the former general counsel of the Defense Department. Now, this is the lawyer for the Department of Defense, the guy who said, yeah, it's okay to torture people. We can make this happen.
If anything came up, there were all sorts of conditions. And not to mention, Senator...
Where in this memorandum is the reference to those conditions?
Not to mention, as you know, the training and the quality of the soldiers.
This is Haynes.
But I think these questions malign.
I object strenuously to that. You did a service to the soldiers of this nation. You empowered them to violate basic conditions which every soldier respects, the Uniform Code of Order of Justice, the Geneva Convention. Here's what soldiers do. You said the Geneva Convention doesn't apply, and they honestly asked, what does apply? And the only thing you sent them was, these techniques apply. No conditions, nothing. So don't go around with this attitude of you're protecting the integrity of the military. You degraded the integrity of the United States military. And I finished my question.
Well, yeah. Amen. Amen. The Reich put into their place. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Steve, thanks for calling. What's up?
Hey, Tom Quigger. Who was that?
That was Jack Reed, the Democrat from Rhode Island.
Okay, very good. Hey, I just want to mention, you know, you get all these conservatives and they're, I guess they're business people that always, you know, want these libertarian ideas. But from a business sense, don't progressive ideas make more business sense?
Yeah, they do. And in fact, when Democrats are elected president, you can go all the way back to the beginning of the 20th century when Democrats or progressives, in the case of Teddy Roosevelt, are elected president, the stock market tends to go up, economic activity goes up, society gets healthier, suicides go down, murder rates go down. When conservatives come into power, and the BBC did a great job of documenting this with conservative administrations over a 100-year period in the UK and Australia, when conservatives come into power, suicides go up, unemployment and homelessness go up, despair goes up, and economic activity goes down. And
right.
We've got a 100-year record in the modern era that we can look at in both the United States, the UK, and Australia.
It seems better to have people employed and you know, supported by various particular government programs, you know, education,
yeah,
safety nets, environment, stuff like that, than it is to have a short-term profit and reduce all those programs.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Steve. Very well said, and thank you for saying it. This is where the commons, this idea, our caller earlier, you know, I talk about the commons a lot. I wrote a book mostly about the commons, We the People. Actually, it's a illustrated book, and it's one of my favorites. This idea that we together can create a nation where we independently can prosper is the foundational idea of the United States, and it has become the European dream, not the American dream. Next week, we're going to be doing our show entirely, the whole week, from Denmark. Denmark, from Copenhagen. Danish Radio has given us their studios, and we're doing it from the studios of Danish National Radio, a socialist radio system, I guess you could call it, and talking about why is Denmark the happiest nation in the world. This is the bookend to the show that we did in March, where I did this show live by satellite phone from Darfur, from the border with Darfur in southern Sudan, in a refugee camp 300 miles from the nearest electricity or road, in the middle of what certainly felt and looked and smelled like hell. And so we're bracketing, you know, the worst place in the world, the happiest place in the world. I think it's going to be fascinating. We're going to get into a lot of detail next week of these questions of what is the commons, how does it work, and what do we have to learn from European nations that are actually finding, even though the sky is gray and maybe more people smoke and drink, yet the country is happier. And the taxes are over 50%. But people are happier. What's the deal? Jim in Hollywood, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Jim.
I think that's the reason why people are generally happier there is because it's just more ingrained in the culture to actually hang out with each other and enjoy each other. I lived in Germany as a kid. I had the opportunity to do that, so I have a little bit more of a framework for that. When I lived in Seattle, there's a lot of public transportation. You walk everywhere, so you have a lot more interaction with people. Here in Los Angeles, you don't see anybody unless you happen to run into them in a car.
Right, and you make an appointment to meet them at a restaurant.
Exactly. The train system that they just put in here, the news was saying, oh, nobody rides that. I don't know why they put that in. They were saying that a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Now you can't even find a seat on that thing.
Really?
You cannot find a seat in the morning. It's packed.
Yeah.
Everybody's paying $5 a gallon for gas here.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Good point. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Andrew in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for the invaluable service you provided the country.
Well,
two points I wanted to make. First is kind of a rhetorical question. Can't somebody, have a class action suit, a lawsuit against the corporate media for false advertising?
No. To the best of my knowledge, it's not the kind of thing that lends itself to a class action lawsuit. What we can have is a class action, though, and that's called elections. We can let our elected officials know that we want them to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act. It is time to break up some of these huge corporations, not just in the media, but right across the board, so that there can be competition, so that entrepreneurs can get into the marketplace. And by the way, if you want entrepreneurs coming into the marketplace, give them back bankruptcy protection so that people can take a risk once again in America. Coming up next, Everything You Know Is Wrong, A Young Woman's Guide to Why Feminism Matters.
Tom Hartman.
Helping you win the water cooler wars.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Listening to Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you do know, and sometimes, even as Fire St. Peter so brilliantly says, everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync, and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is everything you know wrong about feminism? Jessica Valenti is with us, the author of Full Frontal Feminism. Last time, I think it was about a year ago, Jessica, you dropped by our studios in person.
Yep, that's right.
Yep, and your new book, He's a Stud, She's a Slut, and 49 Other Double Standards Every Woman Should Know. This is a great little book.
Thanks. It's quite a mouthful of a title, though, huh?
It is. I particularly like the fact that every chapter, these little short chapterlets, I guess, ends up with a what to do. And let me just toss some of these chapter titles out and let you rant on them briefly, okay?
Sure.
He's a politician. She's a fashion plate.
That's one of my favorites, actually. I think that we probably can all relate to that given the recent campaign craziness. It's just a double standard, about how men in politics don't really ever get judged on their looks, whereas women... you constantly hear about their outfits, their hair, and really sometimes that's all you hear about, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, you talk about how Pelosi was determined to be a certain type of politician based on how she was dressed and how your co-blogger was doing a pastiche of how would it be if we judged men based on the kind of tie they wear and things. Here's another one. He's metrosexual. She's anorexic.
Yeah. Well, I would assume everyone knows what a metrosexual is, I guess, at this point. But the idea that, a guy who pays attention to the way he looks is taking extra care of himself. There's something kind of extra, maybe feminine about him or not okay or mock worthy. Whereas a woman who does, you know, shaves her legs or gets waxed or gets tanned, those are like the minimum standards for what you have to do to, in order to be considered just an acceptable woman at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just being the way that you are is not acceptable. You actually, there's one chapter that he's lucky, she's Lolita, where you start this with a confession.
Yeah.
You talk about being 16 years old and dating a guy who was 20. And thinking that was a pretty good relationship, actually, for about a year. And then realizing, and now in your old age, I guess, that looking back on it, that he could have been sent to jail for statutory rape. And you get into an area here that I think is one that our culture is really, you know, this is something very hot that a lot of people are afraid to touch.
Yeah, a lot of people are not really, you know, very hot on talking about teenage girls' sexuality and the fact that teenage girls do have sexuality and that they can be, you know, proactive agents of that sexuality and make decisions for themselves. You know, we like to paint young girls as either, you know, mostly just victims or whores, but, you know, mostly victims. And if you have sex when you're a teenager, it's because some older guy kind of, you know, pressured you into it. And with my own experience, you know, the guy I dated, he was great and he was very good looking and I was very excited about that as a 16-year-old, but I was kind of smarter than him and, you know, there was no being taken advantage of, and it kind of shocked me to think back on it that really would have been a problem had a lot of people known about it.
Yeah. In fact, you point out he was modeling and you were studying organic chemistry.
Exactly.
So, which brings us to, you know, he's a Romeo, she's a stalker. Again, these kind of not just sexually based, but dating and romance based double standards.
Yeah. And I think this one is actually a dangerous one. You know, when a girl kind of calls a guy too much or pays too much attention to him, she's automatically labeled a stalker, which kind of downplays the real problem of stalking and dating violence. And when guys, you know, won't leave a woman alone or, you know, sending flowers to her house every day, showing up at her house every day, it's considered romantic. And considering the big problem of stalking and dating violence and that it's a, you know, it's a tremendous problem in the U.S., it kind of gives guys an out. It's like, oh, well, he just really likes you a lot.
So what do we do about it for many of these things that we've discussed up to this point? We haven't, you know, I congratulated you for putting solutions in every chapter of the book, and we haven't discussed any of the solutions.
Well, you know, it's hard for all of them. I think the kind of umbrella solution for all of these problems is recognizing them as problems and recognizing them as double standards and being willing to talk about them. And I think especially for younger women, that's sometimes a difficult thing to do, because if you talk about a double standard, especially one that has to do with gender, you're automatically labeled a feminist, and God forbid, you wouldn't want that. Or, you know, you're labeled too opinionated or, you know, too outspoken. So I think just putting those double standards out there is a really important first step.
Here's another one that there have been times in my life when I think probably every man wonders what it would be like to be a woman, and every woman wonders at some point I want to go dress up, you know, cross dress or something like that, but what's that experience? You know, it's like I realized it actually, I think, most clearly probably in my teenage years, reading fiction that was written from a female point of view and suddenly getting it that living inside a woman's skin is a different thing than living inside a man's skin, that the world actually feels differently, that the lace is a different feeling than cotton, kind of thing, you know?
Right.
And I think most men have no sense, perhaps, you know, just this is the reality of life, have no sense of how a woman deals with experiences our modern culture, and arguably many women don't have experience of how a man does. But
sure.
Here you've got this chapter 35, he walks freely, she gets harassed. And
yeah.
This is something that I think is way outside the realm of even ever thought about for a lot of men, and yet is absolute everyday common, even from childhood, for women.
Yeah, you know, people don't recognize that when you're a woman and you walk down the street, or not even down the street, just in any public space, you're taught to be constantly aware of your surroundings and almost constantly afraid. It's like being in a, you know, perpetual state of victimhood where, you know, you walk out on the street and you're, you know, at least for me, if I am walking and I see a guy coming towards me, I know not to make eye contact in case he gets the wrong idea, You put up with harassment on the street. And a lot of guys don't really, I mean, I've been walking with male friends down the street, had someone say something to me, and the guys don't even hear it. They're so, you know, they're so much in their own world.
Yeah.
But it's a really kind of bizarre thing to walk through life knowing that you're a little bit less safe than men are.
Yeah. I knew a woman many years ago who was quite overweight who made the comment to me, and this really kind of rattled me. She said that she felt safer being overweight, that she had no desire to lose weight because her experience younger and thinner was that she got harassed constantly. And so she was quite happy being, you know, 250, 300 pounds. That was kind of a shocker, frankly.
Right. Well, you know, that's not to say that, you know, women of size or larger women don't get harassed. They do, but they also get ignored more often, I think, than not. And yeah, I mean, there is a feeling that you just wish that people would just leave you alone. I mean, there's another chapter in the book about, you know, it almost feels like you're constantly public property when you're walking around, that someone can come up and spark up a conversation with you when you're just sitting reading a book, and you're supposed to be, you know, accessible and open and be like, oh, okay, sure, come talk to me, or you're considered rude. Whereas, if, you know, with a man, if someone walked up to you on the street and was like, hey, how you doing? Can I talk to you a second? You know, you would say no way, and that would be acceptable.
Right. If I said that to another man, my first thought would be, is he trying to pick me up?
Yeah.
You know, and you know, it's typically not something that is acceptable behavior. He's a person, she's a commodity. We're talking with Jessica Valenti, her book, He's a Stud, She's a Slut, and 49 Other Double Standards Every Woman Should Know. And we just have a minute left, Jessica. This is really what you're talking about. He's a person, she's a commodity.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that most feminists would probably say that the commodification of women is one of the larger issues affecting us. I mean, we're everywhere. We're on ads. We sell, you know, any kind of different product. We're not really human beings anymore, it seems like. We're really just kind of vehicles for consumerism.
Women are being used to sell products, not just to men, but to women as well.
But to women as well, of course. And if we're not buying, right, if we're not consuming them, we're not really doing a very good job as women.
Yeah, well, and that meme getting out there as well. We have quite a collection here of stuff we have to confront as a society, I would say.
Just a little bit.
Indeed. Jessica Valenti, her new book, He's a Stud, She's a Slut, and 49 Other Double Standards Every Woman Should Know. Jessica, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Great to talk to you. 16 minutes past the hour. And, oh, by the way, the website, feministing.com is Jessica's website. 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back with Larry Scott from VAWatchdog.org.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Past the hour, Tom Hartman with you. Larry Scott is on the line with us. He is the founder, editor-in-chief, chief cook and bottle washer, all things great over at VAWatchdog.org. Keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. VAWatchdog.org, one of the premier veteran sites in America. And Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you again.
I see both on your website, and I've been watching this in the corporate media as well, that the VA and the White House have apparently been testing drugs on vets without their consent or knowledge.
No, that's not exactly true. It's some of the what's happening here is that some of folks in the blogosphere have kind of stretched and distorted what's actually happened here. If we go back, there are a number of studies going on with combat veterans who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD.
Okay.
And there are studies going on various drugs to help quit smoking. One of those is now the controversial drug Chantix, which many believe can cause suicidal ideation and some real emotional problems.
So presumably it's an SSRI drug like Prozac?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know all of the chemistry involved in the drug, except they feel now that it can be dangerous, and the manufacturer has put out warnings on it. So there are groups of studies that are separate. There are patients who are going through for a PTSD therapy alone, going through anti-smoking therapy alone. And what we have here, what caused this stir in the press, was a group of about 140 veterans that are receiving Chantix therapy to stop smoking and PTSD treatment and therapy at the same time. So one of the gentlemen involved, a 38-year-old veteran, Mr. Elliott, evidently had some real problems with suicidal thoughts and problems, confrontation with the police, ended up in jail. Felt that the drug had something to do with this, and when he went to the media, they went back and started checking, and it appears the VA knew for about 3 months that this was a potentially dangerous drug, but did not inform the veterans in the study for a period of about 3 months. What the VA is claiming is that they took the warnings, they passed them on to the therapists, and what they didn't want to do was just send a warning out to the veterans, by email or by mail and say, hey, you're taking a potentially dangerous drug. They, through channels, sent all of these messages and warnings to the therapists involved and suggested they have one-on-one meetings with the veterans, which in theory sounds good, but when that takes about 3 months, that's not good. Okay. So what we have now is a big brouhaha. The VA says we did the right thing. The White House says they did the right thing. Veterans groups are claiming they didn't do the right thing. We have calls for investigations. Representative Bob Filner of California, who's chairman of the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, says stop the study. If this drug is potentially that dangerous and has this effect on our veterans who are suffering from PTSD, you shouldn't be using it. Others are a little more moderate. They say, let's investigate this and find out why the VA is continuing it. That's kind of where we stand now. But if we go back and look very, very carefully from the beginning, there was informed consent. At the time informed consent was signed by the PTSD patients, these warnings were not available. So the VA is claiming they did the right thing.
All right. Interesting. What else? There's so much on your website. I'm not sure where to begin. What do you consider to be the top stories that veterans need to know about of the families of vets?
Well, we're going to the U.S. Supreme Court, and that's something that doesn't happen very often with veterans issues. There's a case called Sanders versus Peak. I will not get into all the legalities. It's extremely long and involved. But what the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to consider as to what extent, if any, the VA is liable if it fails to inform a veteran of all the information needed to process a claim correctly. In theory, the VA has a responsibility to help veterans process their claim and to provide them with all the necessary information to move that claim through the process. Any veteran who's ever filed a claim will tell you that doesn't happen. The VA generally drops the ball. This case, Sanders versus Secretary Peak, has worked its way through the courts all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. What the justices decide will have a major impact on the way veterans' claims are handled in the future. It's something that's going to bear watching. We should really keep an eye on it.
Yeah, it seems definitely so. And there's the fighting the Army's spit-em-out discharges. We have about a half a minute, Larry.
Yeah. The Army still has a terrible habit of going back, and when soldiers have emotional problems or post-traumatic stress disorder, saying, no, you brought it with you. Personality disorder.
There's people who might be expensive to treat.
Expensive to treat, getting not only military disability, but then VA disability, medical benefits, disability benefits down the line. This has been going on for some time. It really started in Vietnam. It's been happening more and more lately, and it just keeps popping up, and the stories keep coming back and coming back and coming back, Tom. The military is still using the personality disorder discharge to get out of helping veterans.
Hey, Larry, next time you're back, next week when you're back on, would you help me remember, I want to ask you and get into a conversation with you about John McCain's disability payments.
Okay, can do.
I think it would be a fascinating topic. Larry Scott with VAWatchdog.org, the website. Check it out. Larry, thanks for dropping by.
Okay, Tom, great talking with you.
Thank you. 27 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270. Our number, your calls up next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The days come easy and the moments pass slow, and each road leads you where you want to go. And if you're faced with a choice and you have to choose, I hope you choose the one that means the most to you. And if one door opens to another door closed, I hope you keep on walking till you find the window. If it's cold outside, show the world the warmth of your smile. But more than anything, more than anything, my wish for you is that this life becomes all that you wanted till your dreams stay big, your worries stay small.
34 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Justine in Clinton Township, Michigan, listening on WDTW in Detroit. Hey, Justine, welcome to the show. Justine, you are on the air. Hello? Nope. Okay, Matt in Seattle. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Tom Hartman. How's it going?
Tom, great. What's up?
I'd really like to say I appreciate your work on politics and as well as ADD.
Oh, thank you.
I thought it's been very groundbreaking, and we all appreciate it out here in the Northwest.
Well, thank you.
Anyways, I'd like to say that being a 23-year-old male, I've noticed that why people voted for Bush back in the day, their reasons weren't necessarily, I'd say, political.
Right.
It was more of a religious or ethics or values kind of thing.
Well, there is also, I mean, remember Roger Ailes was first hired by the Nixon campaign in order to make Nixon more likable, because they determined back in the 60s that people voted for the person they liked more often than they voted for the person with whom they agreed. And so I think that, you know, Bush, who was born in Connecticut into a very multimillion dollar, you know, very wealthy family, went to Andover and Yale and Harvard and, you know, top prep schools. And he was a preppy all the way, but he was trying to peddle himself as a good old Texan. And so the first thing he did is he went out and bought a hobby farm, calls it a ranch, although it's not. He's afraid of horses, actually. There's no horses there. As Vicente Fox pointed out, the president of Mexico, George is afraid to go near horses. And peddled this image of himself as a good old boy who loves to cut brush. And that, I think, got him more votes, frankly, than his positions.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, it's taken 4 years for me to realize that the only solution to this problem is not being a Democrat or being a Republican, but starting from scratch, in my opinion.
Well, and, yes and no. I mean, you mean joining Ralph Nader and creating another party?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Oh, maybe creating another party, yeah, is my idea, but It can't be left and it can't be right. It has to be somewhere in the middle, stomping the middle ground. And
what does that mean,
Matt? Between.
Give me a middle position, for example, on whether or not we should have a $9 trillion debt and an $800 billion annual deficit.
Not necessarily a middle position in that, but,
okay,
but being in the middle, a mediator, stomping the middle ground and not letting either side.
Right. Well, I'm trying to, you know, people talk about the middle all the time, and I have no idea what they're talking about. I confess. What's the middle position on whether or not we should have Social Security protection for widows, for orphans, for children born with severe deformities and birth defects, unable to care for themselves, and for people who are in their old age and experiencing poverty?
Well, here's my position, I guess you could say, is that I'm not taking a middle ground. I think we're the party of a new party of mediators, where you leave your corporate and religious views at the door, and you come as an American.
Okay, so what's the middle ground on whether what's the middle ground, Matt, on whether or not women should have access to birth control?
Oh no, I totally think you have to take as a new party, you have to take positions. That's not what I'm saying.
Right. So what's the middle ground? What's the middle position on birth control? What's the middle position?
There isn't one.
See, that's the thing. I don't see any middle position on any of these issues. I mean, either you're in favor of the corporate worldview, the conservative worldview, which is that multinational and transnational corporations control everything, including your vote, or you're in favor of the liberal worldview, which is that we, the people, collectively at least administer the commons, that we take care of ourselves with regard to things like unemployment insurance, Social Security, that we have a rational system of taxation and a progressive system of taxation that makes sure that the government is actually bringing in the amount of money, an amount of money equal to what it spends, so we don't go broke, so our currency doesn't go in the toilet, so it doesn't end up that a gallon of gas costs $4 because our dollar has dropped in half against the euro and against the riyadh and you know, Middle Eastern and Saudi Arabian currencies. I mean, I just don't see a middle.
I got to say that I agree with you 99% of the time on everything. I'm just saying that there's good views on both sides of the table.
No, there aren't.
You can't take a middle. You can't take a middle view on such things as, you know, birth control and stuff like that.
Tell me something you can take a middle view on.
My ideas are more towards constructing yourself very, very pointed out what you believe in. And then saying, look, if you're wrong on one side, if the liberals are wrong or if the conservatives are wrong, you got to call them out. You can't be both ways. I mean, Nader's a revolutionary guy in the fact that he just doesn't waver.
No, I agree. I salute Ralph Nader in most of the great work he's done in his life. And if he really wanted to transform the political landscape in America, he would get his Nader's Raiders. He would get people like me. I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000. He would get people like me inside, and frankly, I did it without Ralph Nader, inside the Democratic Party. He would get people volunteering so that we can take over the Democratic Party and turn it back into a progressive party.
Well, we are a new generation of people. I mean, I'm 23 years old, and we have politicians that are far older than I am, and Barack Obama is talking about change, which I totally believe in, and he did that by not taking the corporate view,
he's a liberal. So he's I agree, Matt, but that means that he's a liberal. The media is calling him a liberal. The conservatives are calling him a liberal. I'm a liberal. I'm calling him a liberal. I'm saying that's great. I want a liberal in the White House. I still have yet to hear you tell me one middle position. As much as I agree with you that, you know, having America divided and polar and having people pointing at each other and saying that each other is bad and all that kind of thing, that's probably not a healthy thing for the United States. At the same time, there are these competing visions of America. There are these competing worldviews of who we are as a people and what we should be as a nation and how our laws should be organized and how our corporations should be organized and how our commons should be managed. And these competing worldviews, there's going to be a winner and a loser. And I don't see anything in the middle.
No, I'm not asking America to take a middle view on anything. I'm asking them to be mediators between what's right and what's wrong. I mean, we have a bipartisan country, 50-50 basically at this point. Well, maybe even more towards the liberal side. What I'm saying is in 2004 is that a whole bunch of my friends took George Bush, not for his politics, but for his religion.
Oh,
you need to be able to see past the party, and I think that's the problem in my generation. That's what we're getting at, is that seeing past the party can only be started from scratch.
I think, Matt, I would submit to you respectfully that your generation is suffering from you're the generation that grew up where 100% of the media was infotainment. There basically is no news unless you're watching BBC. They're basically or Amy Goodman's program, Democracy Now.
Listening to you.
Well, thank you. I mean, there basically is no news, and there's been basically, I'm assuming, no real meaningful civics and government classes in the history of the United States in our school system. And so it's like people without that basis, without that understanding of the history of the country and what it means to be conservative, what it means to be liberal, for example, in these different worldviews, without that, people are, you know, they have to have some criteria if they want to be politically active. They want to vote. You guys want to vote. You want to participate. And God bless you. I salute that. And so, you know, the question becomes, okay, what do I vote based on? And it seems like it's like, who do I want to have a beer with?
Exactly. I mean, if you want the truth in this country, you got to go out and get it yourself.
Yeah.
You're not going to hear it on cable TV.
Yeah.
But at the same point, I just I'd like to say that, you know, we've got to start it from scratch somewhere as a new generation. You got to cut the ties at some point.
you gotta leave your religious and corporate affiliations at the door if you're gonna vote with.
Yeah, Matt,
Republicans.
I would suggest that a better metaphor would be it's time to climb on the shoulders of my generation and the generation between us, and take the world from that point rather than separating.
You are the true generation of change, I guess we could say.
Well, and you are now. You are now. I have a child who's, you know, our youngest child is a year older than you are. And, you know, what I'm seeing in all her friends and in her is that you guys are the generation that's going to save this world and save this country. And I congratulate you for it. And I honor the fact that you're listening to the show and that you are active. Man, thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along. I got a bunch of other people here, but thank you for the call. Charles in Seattle. Hey, Charles.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just great. What's up?
I just want to recognize the young man and all the young people, frankly, because a few years ago, I would have never heard so many young people that are just paying attention or starting to look at it. I think it's wonderful.
Yep. This is the revitalization and, frankly, the survival of this country as a democracy is going to depend on people under 30 years old.
Absolutely, and let's face it, they're the ones that are going to have to pay the bills and clean up the social and economic and other messes that we've been making for the last 30 years.
That's right, ever since Reagan.
My point was about Ralph Nader. I heard him on Democracy Now! This morning. I admire and respect the guy a lot. He was, as Ed would say, spot on almost every issue. But what bothers me is that he seems to be in a state of denial that I could only compare maybe to the state of denial of a George Bush type. But he's in a state of denial to me about the fact that we're in a two-party system. The only viable near-term option is to take over the Democratic Party, get more Kucinich's and more Waxmans and more people working for the rest of us instead of just the CEOs among us.
Absolutely. Well said, Charles. Thank you. And this is a discussion that I've had with Ralph on a couple of occasions. I have tremendous respect for Ralph Nader. I don't want him running for political office. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Say thank you to those Democrats who have opposed things like Steny Hoyer's new proposal that we give immunity to the telco companies. Man, this is so bad, and it's coming back. It's coming. I'm telling you, it's coming back. Let your member of Congress know, no get out of jail free card for the telephone companies and for the Bush administration that asked them to break the law, and then they, with their multi-million-dollar legal departments and their $1,000-an-hour lawyers said, oh, yeah, sure, we'll break the law. There is something really rotten here, and Congress or our court system needs to get to the bottom of it. Don't give them immunity. Let them instead testify in the upcoming trials of George Bush and his buddies, which will hopefully start next year. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, yeah, actually, Hoyer said today in his pen and pencil that they were very close to a final agreement. He said the bill could be on the floor as early as Friday, and he said that this is under this deal, the secret court created by the original get to review in advance the process by which the administration chooses a foreign surveillance target. So one goes through each one who may be communicating, and then is the issue of the immunity.
Right. Right. But his legislation, I'm assuming, from what I've read, his legislation is going to offer immunity to these telco companies, right?
It looks like do that, although we don't know exactly what the deal will be. As you know, the House Democratic have been trying to keep the conservatives off of this, and it's the blue dogs that are really pushing them on it.
I think the biggest problem they have are the people who are taking money from the telco companies.
But, and there's a lot of them. Yeah. There is a lot of them.
Yeah. So what else is going on in Washington, D.C. and the world?
Vetoed the farm bill. The override will probably happen in the House, and then the Senate will take it on again. Barack Obama had his first working group at this at the old Holiday Inn New Liaison Hotel in Washington. They allowed press to hear their opening statement. At his new table is Albright, Lee Hamilton, Richard Danzig, James Steinberg, Greg Craig. These are all people who have been involved in stuff. Tim Romer from the 9/11 Commission, William Perry, Tony Lake, David Boren. All sort of middle of the road. There aren't any big lefties on his panel.
I think he's one of two things is going on. Either Barack Obama is more tolerant of the corporate mainstream, quote unquote, than progressives hoped, or he is trying to embrace a larger, you know, our caller Matt earlier, you know, he's trying to go to the middle, whatever that means, in order to win the election. And then what's going to emerge out of that is either going to be a Democrat who behaves like a Republican, like Bill Clinton did, or is going to be Franklin Roosevelt, you know, a Democrat who behaves like a Democrat. Roosevelt, let's not forget, campaigned as a moderate. So I don't know. You know.
Right. I mean, this was a very sort of presidential-looking meeting. Obama was sitting there with a senior working group when the press came in, and apparently, according to the Pool Report, which we just got, there were three sides of a square table, and then Sam Nunn and Warren Christopher had called in, and there was a long row of American flags behind him, you know, all the typical. Mm.
So it's sort of like he's president and he's having a cabinet meeting.
Exactly. I think it was designed to look that way.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, good. That's a good meme to get out there. What else is up?
Also, a group of House Democrats today held a press conference, and they said that U.S. cannot drill its way to lower prices. This was mainly a group of Democrats, and they said that they were concerned that there was oil on federal lands and offshore, and they did not want to drill that because they said the oil that couldn't be produced from these reserves is 10 times the amount of ANWR, but they're very concerned about the environmental issues, and they're saying the Republicans are saying ways to set up material. They want refineries. Well, do we own the refineries? No, he said. The oil companies own the refineries.
Right.
And they're the ones responsible. So everybody's saying, oh, the feds need to drill the oil refineries. So that's just not the case.
Yeah. And on top of all of this, you've got the Department of Energy itself. Bush's own Department of Energy in 2005 saying that if the 18 billion barrels of oil in the OCS and they was brought online, roughly double that of the Arctic Reserve, even tomorrow morning, it would still, you know, it would have little or no impact to the price of the pump today or tomorrow. We're looking
that
at changes.
Oil goes on to the open market.
Right, and then even then we're looking at hopefully changes in the price of oil in 2025 because, you know, it takes a while for this stuff to happen.
But that's for sure. And again, that doesn't solve the issue that we're still dealing with a limited resource when there may be resources, wind, et cetera, right, that can be renewable.
Yeah. Yeah. Wind power could, without any technological improvements whatsoever, right now be easily providing 20% of the nation's electricity, according to a couple of different studies that I've seen just in the last few weeks. What else is going on in the world? We have about a minute here, Ellen.
Okay. Well, let's take a look at the issue that is going on with the McCain campaign. We're hearing that a lot of folks are feeling that the McCain campaign is very insular, not very open to foreign policy. He's decided what he wants, and he's not very open, which is, of course,
sort of like Bush.
Yeah, exactly. You've heard that story completely before.
He's not just running for the third term of Bush's presidency. He wants to become Bush himself for the third term.
And as you know, the president is saying that the Democratic Congress needs to allow for increased domestic production of oil. I mean, it's the same old, same old.
Yeah, well said. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Tomorrow, Yaron Brook, president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute. We're going to talk about salmonella, tomatoes, and food safety. Plus, we're going to get into the issue of right-wing hate speech with Rory O'Connor. He's going to stop by and talk about his new book, Shock Jocks. hate speech, and talk radio. And, of course, the best of the rest of the news. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.